All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is Mance Rader, and I am here with the great Dr. Walter Block. How are you doing today, doctor?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me on your show.
Cool. I wanted to talk about as far as I'm concerned, if I was going to talk about what a society that was ruled by private property, by private property rights, a libertarian society would look like, you are the person I would want to talk to. But I would like you, for the listeners, to go over your rap sheet, go over your credentials, and you've written 24 books, and I mean, just the amazing things that you've done. So talk a little bit about yourself.
Well, my biggest credential is that I once shook the hands of Ludwig von Mises, and I never washed my hands since. It's a little dirty, but if you shake my hand, you get in contact with Mises. So that's my biggest credential. My second biggest credential is I was friends for many years with Murray Rothbard. He was my mentor. He was my tutor. He was my friend. And I learned a lot from him, from speaking to him, from laughing at his jokes, from reading his books. So that's my second best credential. I guess other credentials, I have a PhD in economics from Columbia. I studied with Gary Becker, Nobel Prize winner in economics. And I've got about 25 books and about 550 referee journal articles. And, I don't know, several thousand op-ed pieces. And I give lots of speeches, and I do a lot of interviews like I'm now doing. So I guess that's where I'm from. Other credentials, I ran for assembly in New York State in 1969 before the National Party started. I didn't win, but I ran. I'm a longtime libertarian. I'm also associated with the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, which is the mecca, the groundswell, the mainspring of libertarianism and Austrian economics.
Awesome. Yeah, it's an honor to talk to you. The first thing I wanted to ask was, I've heard you say, privatize everything. If it moves, privatize it. If it doesn't move, privatize it. Why is everything being privatized so important in your thinking?
Well, the idea here is if it's not privatized, there are only two other solutions. The government owns it or no one owns it, or I guess we own it in common. The problem with the government owning it is government is a coercive institution. It initiates violence against innocent people. So to have it own anything is sort of like giving the chicken coops over to the fox. To have ownership in common breeds the, what do they call it, the tragedy of the commons, where if we all own something, it doesn't inure to the benefit of any one of us much to safeguard it, and we all overuse it, and it sort of goes away, like the buffalo were never owned privately. They were owned in common or unowned, and people would just shoot them because if you didn't shoot them, the price of not shooting them would be very, very low. Namely, you wouldn't have the buffalo tomorrow if you didn't shoot it today. Whereas the cow, if you shot it, you would have had that cow, but you don't have it now because you shot it. So, the cow never went within a million miles of extinction, whereas the buffalo almost did. And the same with the whales and the elephant and the rhino and, groups like that. So, government ownership and non-ownership and ownership in common are not good. They're problematic from a utilitarian point of view. And they're also problematic from a deontological point of view of rights. I own this shirt. What's wrong with that? That means you can't have it. You've got a hat there and I can't have it unless I buy it from you or you give it to me voluntarily. So private property rights are very important because we need a system to know who can wear which hat and which shirt. Otherwise, people will be unsure. This shirt was in my closet this morning, but did I have a right to use it? I don't know. Without private property rights, I wouldn't know. And then there's conflict. You know, you might think you own it, and we have to have some sort of rule to determine who owns it. So I think private property rights are very important.
Well, The communist, the socialist would say that shirt you're wearing is personal property. They try to make a distinction between personal and private property. They don't mind if your toothbrush is your personal property, but your house, your business, your whatever, they want that to be the, the property of everyone.
Right. Well, they're very decent, those guys. You have to hand it to them. They'll allow us to have toothbrushes and shirts and underwear and stuff like that. But they won't allow us to have capital goods, machinery, buildings, land, things like that. And we saw how well that worked out in the Soviet Union. We saw how that worked out in Cuba and North Korea and places like that. It didn't work out too well pragmatically. Again, I'm not that interested in pragmatism or utilitarianism, although I am a bit interested, and I'm more interested in the rights. I cut down a tree, I build a boat, and now you say I can't own the boat because the boat is a capital good? Well, you're a thief if you say that. I don't see why I shouldn't be able to own anything that I mix my labor with, according to the Lockean homesteading theory, and that certainly includes capital goods and trees and land and boats and things like that.
Okay, let's get into you literally wrote the book on it, The Privatization of Roads and Highways.
Yes. Let me dig that book out if I can. I've got it right here. I like to wave it around at people. There's that book, The Privatization of Roads and Highways. And I think it's a great book. I wrote it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have written it if I didn't think it was good. And part of the reason, I guess there are three reasons why I wrote it, three motivations. Perhaps the least important is the fact that people are always saying, well, who will build the roads? Who will run the roads if we don't have government? Thank God for the state, because if we didn't have the state, we wouldn't have roads. That's perhaps the third most important reason. The second most important reason is traffic congestion. You're from Bronx. I'm from Brooklyn. You're now in Atlanta. I'm in New Orleans. And in all these places, in any big city, 8:30 in the morning at 5 in the afternoon, you can hardly drive. If you have a bicycle, you're probably faster than a car because of traffic congestion. And that's horrible. I mean, it's just such a waste of time. People are sitting there twiddling their thumbs, getting angry at each other because you cut me off and I'm going to get you, and you have road rage. But the most important reason for that is, do you know how many people die on the highways? Something like
close to 35,000, 40,000 a year?
40,000. It depends. Every year it's a little different. Somewhere between 30 and 40,000. To just put that number in perspective, how many people died in 9/11? Only a stinking, lousy 3,000 people. How many people died in Katrina? 1,900 people. Now, look, every life is precious, and 3,000 lives and 1,900 lives are very, very important, and they were great tragedies. And our society took cognizance of that, and we know that 9/11 was a bad thing, and we should try to not have that again, and we know that what happened with Katrina was a bad thing. But somehow 35, 38, 39,000 people a year die. That's many, many more people, and it occurs every year. Thank God Katrina only occurred once. Thank God 9/11 only occurred once. This is every year. This is horrible. This is a disgrace. This is a menace. And that was my main motivation for writing this book, that we should have private ownership of roads, and each person should own a road, and then we would have competition. I mean, the reason we have pretty good shirts and pretty good hats and pretty good, pens is because we have competition. And if you don't make a good pen, and I make a good pen, I'm going to drive you out of business, and then the pens will, on average, be a little bit better. That's why we have pretty good things. Not excellent, because the human condition is such that, we're just not excellent. We're not in the Garden of Eden. But we're pretty good. We have pretty good computers and pretty good TVs and pretty good air conditioning. And the reason for that is private property and competition. So all I'm trying to do in this book is say, well, why can't we apply that to roads? So let me give you a few examples of how possibly, if we owned roads privately, we'd be safer. And my estimate is that instead of 40,000 people dying on the roads, maybe 10,000 would die, because I think even on a private enterprise, there'd be deaths, because, if people are going 60, 70 miles an hour, you're going to have some deaths, but I think we could radically reduce it. Okay, so Right now, we have the rules of the road emanating from Washington, D.C., and they stipulate, you're in Atlanta, so you're not near the I-10. I'm near the I-10 and the I-55. And on those roads, the minimum speed is 40 and the maximum speed is 70. And that's the rule for every major highway in the country. And usually I do 75 on a highway if it's clear. And people pass me. They're going 78, 79, 85. And then again, I pass people who are doing 50, 55. Maybe it's not speed. Maybe it's the variation in speed. Maybe what we should do is instead of having a maximum of 70 and minimum of 40 on all three lanes, we should say the right lane, everyone has to do 50. The middle lane, everyone has to do 65. And the left lane, everyone has to do 80. Would that be better? I don't know. I'm not a road theoretician. All I am is an economist trying to apply economics to an area where it hasn't been applied to. So I say 50, 65, and 80. On your road, it's going to be 50, 60, and 70. On somebody else's road, it'll be 60, 70, and 80. And then we'll see which is better. Then we'll learn. The only way you're going to learn which rules of the road are best is to have different people try different things and then see. So I claim that that would be one way to save lives. Another way to save lives is then on my roads, say a three lane highway, if you're going slow in the left lane, let's say I have this, 50, 65, and 80, and you're sitting in the left lane doing 55. Now everybody's sort of got to go around you, right? Because you got this guy sitting in the left lane going slowly. Now maybe it's lane changing that creates havoc, and I think it might well be. So what I would do on my road is if anyone goes slow in the left lane, I'd give them a very big ticket. Here's another way to save lives. Again, what they have in common is the motif of different people trying different things, and then we'll see which one works best. So we now have a two-lane highway, two lanes in the same direction, and there's truck A ahead and truck B behind. And you know truck B is going to pull out and try to pass truck A, and it's going to take them 15 minutes to pass because they go both at about the same speed. So what I do, I shouldn't do this, and don't tell anyone that I do this. What I do is I see truck A and truck B one behind the other. I go up to 95 and I try to get ahead of them. Otherwise, I'm going to have to wait 15 minutes for the truck to pass. So on my road, I would say anytime trucks do that, you know, go side by side for 15 minutes, you got to give a ticket to the guy on the right, the slower truck, because he should just slow down by 2 miles an hour, let the other guy pass, and then traffic could go by. So again, this creates, I think, I don't know, because I'm not a road expert. I don't know anyone who is a road expert. I'm just a plain old mere economist trying to apply, what I learned about shirts and pens and shoes to roads. And I say that if we had different private ownership, we would learn which is best, and then we would have better roads. It's sort of like, McDonald's introduces fish or something, and then Burger King introduces, I don't know, pizza, whatever. And they each try different things to try to attract customers. That's why they're pretty good. Imagine if government ran all the restaurants, and you would just go to the restaurant, and it would have the same stuff in every restaurant. We wouldn't be happy campers, and yet that's what we do on the roads. So, again, I'll wave this book around, and I say that if you want to read this book, half of it is why it would be best to do that. And the other half, it's a pretty thick book. I don't know how many pages it is. Oh, 500 pages almost. The other half is dealing with objections. Like, would you really need eminent domain to have a road because of the holdout problem? And what about, I put a road in front of your house and I won't let you out or I won't let you in. I sort of box you into your house. And there's a whole bunch of objections if we had private roads. And I try to anticipate as many of them as I can and try to say, no, the market would work well despite these objections.
That was very clear. That was very, that was crystal clear. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I told I told somebody on Twitter that you were going to be on. I announced on Twitter you were going to be on, and a couple questions came in. So I wanted to hit you with a question about what a libertarian society would look like. And this one is one that always comes up. I don't ever hearing you talk about it, although I know you probably have at some point, probably many times, the problem of pollution, people poisoning water, and just, you know, basic environmentalism. What would be the checks and balances?
When you said that, I thought you were going to ask, what about the poor? That's another question everybody always asks.
I might come back to that.
When you talk about air and water, I got another book, and it's called, what is it called? Water Capitalism, The Case for Privatizing Oceans, Rivers, Lakes, and Aquifers. I have a three-part series. This is privatizing roads. This is privatizing water, bodies of water. And my third book in this series, I have a co-author on the latter two, Peter Lothian, is privatizing space, moon, the Mars, space race, and what have you. So it's sort of a three-stage program on privatization. My motto is, if it moves, privatize it. If it doesn't move, privatize it. And since everything either moves or doesn't move, privatize everything. Okay, let's talk about pollution. Now, whether it's air pollution or water pollution or noise pollution or smell pollution, it really doesn't matter that much. The way the mainstream economists will treat this is they'll say it's an external diseconomy and it's a market failure. I engage in building these pens. And when I build these pens, I need, metal here, and I need ink, and I need some sort of spring for the pen. And what happens is I heat up the water because my factory is near a river, and then I spew forth out of my chimney all sorts of soot and particles and smoke that get into your lungs and into your laundry if you hung laundry on a laundry line, a clothesline. And they say, well, you know, the government's got to step in, and there are various ways. You know, Pigou says we should have a tax, and Coase has some cockamamie scheme, and other people have, regulations. We should just limit how much carbon I can use and all that. Here, my guide on many, many other things, but here also is a piece by Murray Rothbard. He wrote it in 1982. I forget the exact title, but it has air pollution in it. And it is the best thing ever written on environmental economics. I teach a course on environmental economics, and I use that that essay there. And what Murray says is, look, this is not market failure. This is trespass. This is trespass. When I shoot particles of soot into the air and it goes onto your property and ruins your crops, it's as if I'm maybe not shooting bullets, which would be more serious, but I'm shooting stuff onto your land that you don't want on your land. That's good old trespass. And Murray tells the story that in the 1830s, there was this little old lady who hung up her clothing on a clothesline. And when she hung it up, it was wet and clean. And when she came out 2 hours later, it was dry and dirty. And she goes to the court and says, that there factory over there, 2 miles away, polluted my laundry, and I want two things. I want an injunction and an indictment, an injunction and damages. Damages means I want some money to pay for the fact that I got to wash my laundry again, and I want an injunction. Namely, I want a letter from the court that says to this factory, hey, cut it out or we'll put you in jail because you're a trespasser. Or there was a farmer, and he had some haystacks, and a railroad came by, the choo-choo train came by, and it set off sparks, and it burned his haystacks. And the farmer goes to the court and says, well, you know, I want damages and an injunction. And did the courts always grant this? No, not always, because sometimes it was a false claim. The plaintiff didn't prove his case. But in other cases, and in many cases, the court found that, yes, this is a violation of rights, and you should pay damages, and if you do, and we'll give you a year to, you know, cut it out, and then, you know, they were reasonable. They don't have to cut it out tomorrow. It's not like you're shooting bullets, but, you know, you got to cut it out or radically reduce it, and otherwise you're going to jail. And this had very good effects on the environment. Namely, people were led, as if by Adam Smith's invisible hand, to use anthracite coal rather than sulfur coal. Anthracite coal is more expensive but cleaner burning. Sulfur coal is much cheaper but dirty burning. So if you use sulfur coal, you're going to get little old ladies and farmers on your case. So you use anthracite coal. It costs a little bit more, but you you swallow the cost because you don't want to have a lawsuit and pay damages. And also you had environmental forensics, where you get a burgeoning industry to find out, where did this dust come from? You know, did it come from this factory or that factory? So that was good. And then factories had an incentive to put mesh or screens in their chimneys to capture most of the soot and the dust, not all of it. You know, there's always imperfections. We breathe out, and that's carbon dioxide. And things were working pretty well. But then came the progressive period in the 1890s, and now in the 1880s, 1890s, the U.S. wanted to be number one. Who was number one in the world? Great Britain. How do you get to be number one? You got to have a lot of tanks and a lot of airplanes and whatever, rifles. And in order to get rifles and tanks and planes, you have to have smeltering and steel and iron and stuff like that. So the next time some little old lady or farmer comes into court and says that their factory or that their railroad is polluting me, the court would say something very different. It wouldn't say, well, is the plaintiff correct? Is there really been a violation? They would say, look, yes, yes, they violated your private property rights. Your stinking, lousy, selfish private property rights. There's something more important than private property rights. You know what that is? It's the public good. And what does the public good consist of? The public good consists of allowing the steel factory to do its thing. Because if we want to have a battleship, we got to have a steel factory. We can't have little old ladies messing with the steel factory. So what they did is they offered a SOP to the plaintiff. They said, what we'll do is we'll have minimum smokestack height regulations. Now, instead of a 10-foot chimney, you have a 50-foot chimney, and now the pollution goes miles and miles instead of, you know, staying local. So you can't tell where the pollution is coming from. So it got very bad, and the problem, and it got so bad, you had to have a Clean Air Act and all that. But this is a Misesian Mises point. You know, the government has one fallacy, one regulation that leads to problems, and then they have another regulation leads to more problems. They have another regulation, and eventually we get socialism if you keep going down that road. So the solution is to go back to suing malefactors, suing people who are polluting. Now, one objection to this is, well, how about cars? There are, I don't know how many cars there are in the country, 300 million, 200 million. Each car produces 1/1,000,000th of a percent of all the pollution, right? A very small amount. So what are you going to do, sue each car? Well, in law, they have this thing called de minimis. You know, the law doesn't take into account trifles. So what Murray says is, look, you don't sue each car owner. What you do is you sue the road owner. And the reason you can't sue the road owner is the road owner is the government. But in the full free enterprise system, you'd have a road owner, and you'd say to the road owner, look, you're engaging in a pollution house, and you better stop it. And then the road owner will turn around and say to people, look, if you don't have a catalytic converter, and if your car is spewing forth all sorts of stuff, we'll allow you on the road, but we're going to charge you triple. And now people are going to start saying, hey, you know, maybe I'd better have a catalytic converter. Maybe I'd have a better system so I don't pollute so much. And the problem would tend to be solved. Not perfectly, but it would be solved. Right now, the problem isn't solved perfectly. It's never solved perfectly. But the problem emanated from the fact that the government wouldn't allow the free enterprise system to work, and then they blame free enterprise.
Isn't that the way they do it every time? It's we're going to add this regulation, this regulation, this regulation, this regulation. Everything falls flat. Oh, free market failed.
You're so cynical.
Well, let me go to another privatization question that comes up all the time. It has to do with military. How would a libertarian city or a libertarian society protect itself from foreign invasion?
Well, there are various versions of libertarianism. My own version is the anarcho-capitalist version, but most libertarians are not anarcho. Oh, okay, good. You're a fellow weirdo.
Yeah, definitely.
Most libertarians are not anarcho-capitalists. Most are minarchists. Minarchists is minimal government libertarianism. And they would say, people like Ayn Rand and Ron Paul, people like that, and they would say, look, there's a legitimate function of government, and that's to protect the persons and property of the citizens and the residents. And in order to do this, you really need three institutions. One is the army to keep foreign bad guys off of us. The other is police to keep local bad guys off of us. And the third is courts to determine who the good guys and who the bad guys are. Or if I sell you, this pen and you say, well, it's not working, it's not good guys versus bad guys, but we're having a commercial dispute and we need a court to determine who pays who or not. So the answer would be, the U.S., if it was a minimal state government, would be a much richer government than a much richer country than any other country, especially any other country that's not free enterprise. And, you know, they say wealthier is healthier. Well, wealthier is also safer from foreign invaders. If your per capita income is 10 times the per capita income of some other country, you're going to be able to afford defensive armaments in a way that the other country is not going to be able to afford offensive armaments. So I think the country would be safe because we'd be free enterprise and we would be much wealthier than any potential invader. Look, right now, the U.S. has, 1,000 military bases in about 130 different countries, something like that? That's not defense. That's offense. No country would dare attack us. That's ridiculous. Instead, what we do is we take a stick and we poke a stick in hornet's nests all over the place, North Korea, Syria, South America, Africa, everywhere, Afghanistan. We've been there for two decades almost. And then we wonder why people come and do us bad in 9/11. Well, they get ticked off at us. So I think a safe country would be one that the founding fathers wanted, namely, George Washington said we don't have entangling alliances, and John Quincy Adams said we don't go abroad in search of dragons to slay. We wish every other country safety, but we fight only for our own. What were we doing in World War I? What were we doing in World War II? What are we doing in Vietnam? What are we doing in 130 countries? So if we had a libertarian government, and that's not a contradiction, if we had a libertarian government, we'd be very, very safe, very secure. And it's not because we're so big. Switzerland, I've just sort of described Switzerland, a very free enterprise country, and it's never been invaded, and they're very wealthy, and they protect themselves, and they don't go out on foreign adventurism. Nobody's attacking Switzerland. Even the Muslims, no terrorists are attacking Switzerland as far as I can see. So I think if the U.S. were like a gigantic Switzerland, we'd be much better off.
What about an anarcho-capitalist society? How would an anarcho-capitalist society protect itself?
Well, I think along the same lines. First of all, it would even be richer than a minimalist government society. We'd be very, very wealthy. And rich people don't get attacked. They have guards. They have protections. We would have defense agencies. And the defense agencies would amalgamate in case there was an external attack. I mean, if Mexico and Canada wanted to gang up on us, you know, the defense agencies in, Minnesota and New York and Washington State and Texas and Arizona, would repel the southern invaders and the other states, the northern invaders. But I think we would be so wealthy as a society, even more wealthy than otherwise, that nobody would dare attack us. And also, if we were an anarcho-capitalist society, we wouldn't be sticking our noses in areas that don't belong to us. We had the Monroe Doctrine, you know, leave us alone, we'll be safe behind two oceans. Look, poor Poland didn't have an ocean to protect itself from the Germans and the Russians. Even Poland, if Poland had an anarcho-capitalist society, I think they would be safer. Would they be safe? I can't say that. The economist was asked, how is your wife? And the answer was, compare to what? Well, we're lucky we have two oceans, and for much of history, two oceans was a good protection. So I don't say that a Poland would be safe if it was anarcho-capitalist. All I say was it would be safer. because it would be triply rich. And when you're very, very wealthy, you can come up with ways to protect yourself that you can't when you're relatively poor. So it's not that anarcho-capitalism is nirvana. It's not that anarcho-capitalism is Garden of Eden. It's just that anarcho-capitalism is better. And that's all we can do. We can just improve things when we go from a minarchism to an anarcho-capitalist society.
I want to ask you, I have one more privatization question written here, and then I want to jump into just a couple more, jump off of that topic. Ever since Trump got into office, ever since he started running for office, we started hearing, it's almost like his main thing was build the wall, build the wall, build the wall. Borders. It's obvious to me how borders would be taken care of in a private society, but you can explain it a lot better than I can. So, would we have issues with borders?
Well, what you're really asking is about immigration. What's the libertarian view on immigration policy, I think?
Yeah, that works.
Before I go on, I just wanted to say that this water capitalism is not my book. I have a co-author, Peter Lothian Nelson. I think it's only fair to mention that I mentioned the book, and I don't want people to think I wrote it. I wrote it with a co-author who made a very important contribution, at least half. Okay, what's the immigration? I'm sorry.
No, thank you for stating that.
Okay, what's the libertarian view on immigration? I'll change the topic slightly from borders. Well, you know, there are two issues where libertarians are very, very much. There's great controversy among libertarians. One of them is abortion. You have Ron Paul, who's pro-life. You have Murray Rothbard, who's pro-choice. And they're both excellent libertarians. They're both leaders of libertarianism, and yet they're 180 degrees apart. Well, you have the same thing in immigration. You have people who are open borders, like me. And then you have other people like Murray Rothbard and Hans Hoppe and Lou Rockwell and others associated with the Mises Institute, as I am, which just shows that in the Mises Institute, you're allowed to disagree with each other. Not a cult. Who are not closed borders, but they're against open borders. Namely, they want to have limited immigration and usually based not on family reunification, but, you know, if you're a physicist or a chemist or a mathematician or an engineer or a doctor, you're allowed in, whereas if you're a homeless bum type, you're not allowed in. Okay, so what's the deal on immigration? And how can we solve this problem between the open borders and the limited open border people? And I divide my analysis here on two grounds. One is utilitarian pragmatist point of view, and the other is deontology, libertarian deontology. See, I'm an open borders person, but I'm an open borders person who worries about rapefugees. What's a rapefugee? A rapefugee is someone who comes from the Middle East and goes to Sweden and thinks that if a woman is wearing a miniskirt, the only way to deal with her is to rape her. So they're rapefugees. They rape and they're refugees. And then there are the truckfugees, people who take a truck and they go to a crowded area and they mow down a whole bunch of people. Well, I think that's a big problem. And a lot of the open borders people I disagree with, and they poo-poo that problem. They say, well, there are only a few that do this and it's not so bad and whatever. I think it's despicable what they do, and I think we should do everything we can to stop that. On the other hand, I go through the following scenario. I say, suppose somebody comes in to the middle of Wyoming in the Rocky Mountains or in the middle of Alaska and comes in, say, by helicopter or somehow he gets there, or he comes from Mars or India or Africa. I don't care where he comes from. And he starts homesteading unhomesteaded land, virgin territory. There's plenty of virgin territory in the Rockies. If you're in a plane and you look over the Rockies and you look down, it is empty. You go over Alaska, there are no people in Alaska. I mean, there are a few Juneau and Fairbanks along the coast, but there are no people in Alaska. So here's a guy, an immigrant. He comes in and he starts homesteading. He plants some corn. He domesticates a cow, whatever it is, and he starts him and a few hundred people, and they're living there. Did he violate rights? No, he didn't violate rights. Therefore, anyone from ICE or any policeman or any Border Patrol person who comes to him and says, hey, show me your papers. And he says, what papers? I don't have papers. And he says, well, you're going to jail. He is violating the rights of the immigrant. So this is the case for open borders. On the other hand, we have the rape refugees and the truck refugees. So how do we have our cake and eat it? You see, the problem I have with the limited open border people like Murray Rothbard and Hans Hoppe, they say, look, rape refugees, truck refugees, keep them out. And I say, yes, I want to keep them out, but I don't want to violate libertarian principle because I have this lust, love, perversion for libertarian theory. I want to promote libertarian theory. I don't want to safeguard us at the cost of libertarian theory. I want to have our cake and eat it. I want to safeguard us from rape refugees and truck refugees, and I don't want to violate libertarian principle. So how do I do it? And I've written several articles on this. What I say is, getting back to the P word, privatization, privatize every square inch of the country. Privatize every road, privatize every river, lake, river, whatever, privatize every square inch of Alaska and of Wyoming and Colorado and all those places that are just empty, Nevada. Then, when everything is privatized, then if somebody comes in, we say, hey, guess what? You're a trespasser. Get out. You're a criminal. So in that way, we can have our cake and eat it. We can safeguard ourselves, and we don't violate libertarian principle. Now, what Hans Hoppe would say, here's an objection. He would say, well, you know, the government really is the guarantor or the guardian of all that property. All that property that I said was virgin territory and never owned in the middle of Wyoming, in the Rocky Mountains, in the middle of Alaska. The government really isn't the owner, but the government is the guardian of it. And I say, well, that's a very strange view for an anarcho-capitalist to take. They're not the guardian. They never mix their labor with any of that land. That land is empty. So I insist that the only solution is privatization. And again, I resort to my little aphorism. If it moves, privatize it. Doesn't move, privatize it. Privatize everything. Well, you see, this is the problem when you don't have private property rights. If we had private property rights, the whole problem would go away. Because then we would be selective. We'd say, yes, you're an engineer, you're a doctor, you're a physicist, you're a philosopher. Sure, come on in. And there are people that will welcome you. So there'll be a university that'll hire you. There'll be a corporation that wants to hire you. You can set up your own business. You're coming in with some money. That's no problem. But when the terrorist types come in, you know, nobody wants them. And we would be able to kick them out if they came in and keep them out from coming in the first place, because they would have to come in to already own property. But this means, you know, you're from New York, Central Park has got to be privatized. I'm from New Orleans. We have Audubon Park a half a mile away from me. It's got to be privatized, because if it's not privatized, the immigrant comes in the middle of Audubon Park and says, hey, here I am. And we as libertarians can't say him nay. We can't say, well, you know, you're on private property. It's not private property. It's government property, and it's a virtue to homestead a government property to get it into private hands. So that would be my answer to the immigration or borders issue.
Well, I'm glad to hear that the whole net taxpayer, that the government is a government's holding public land in trust for a net taxpayer, for the net taxpayers. I'm very happy to hear that you don't subscribe to that, because I could never logically get that, understand exactly where that argument was coming from. And I've heard it a lot in the last 24 months, and it just doesn't seem logical. But let me ask you a question, okay? You wrote the book about defending the indefensible. Defend who, if the United States was a completely private, it was all private property, defend the person who would allow, who would be bribed, who would take a bribe to let somebody go over their property to, over their private property to go to the next property.
Well, I have two books in my Defending the Undefendable series. This is really Defending the Undefendable, plain old, but here's my second book, Defending the Undefendable 2. I would have called this Defending the Undefendable 1, but I didn't know that I'd be writing another one, and right now I'm working on Defending the Undefendable 3.
Forgive me for saying indefensible. I'm sorry. I have that book right. It's on this tablet right here. So I'm sorry.
I'm very litigious. I might be suing you. I'm not sure which chapter you're referring to. I have one chapter on, I think I've got it right.
Well, I was actually just making that one up off the top of my head since we were talking about private property and we were talking about borders and talking about immigration. I was saying if off the top defend the person who would accept the private property owner who would accept a bribe to have somebody go across their property and go to the next property.
Well, I do have a chapter called The Dishonest Cop, and that's somebody like he's going to arrest the prostitute, and then the prostitute bribes him out of it, and I say the dishonest cop should allow that. I don't have a chapter, but I can extrapolate. but let me see if I understand this. In other words, you own some land, and I want to get past your land into your neighbor's land, and I bribe you into allowing me to cross your land so I can get to your neighbor's land?
Correct.
Well, nothing wrong with that. I mean, I wouldn't call it a bribe. A bribe is something sort of nefarious. I'm just asking you, hey, can I rent the services of your land just so that I can walk across your half mile of land? And you say, okay, well, I'm like a tenant of yours, very brief. It only takes 10 minutes to walk a half mile. And you say yes, and we make a deal. So I don't really see that there's much of a challenge here.
Okay. Well, one of my favorites that I'd like to hear you talk about, Defending the Slumlord.
Ah, the Slumlord. Yes, my man. I do have a chapter. I forget which book I put it in. It's one of these books. I forget which one is which, but I can talk extemporaneously about my man, the Slumlord. Now, the slumlord has got a bad press because, you know, there are rats in his apartment and the paint is peeling and the hot water isn't as reliable as it should be. And there's no air conditioning and the elevator doesn't work or there's no elevator. And people say, well, you know, we should not allow slums. We should rip down the slums and put in public housing or something like that, tenements. And what I'm saying is, look, there are Rolls Royces, and then there are Hondas, and then there are Yugos. A Yugo is sort of like a slum car, and Rolls Royce is like a luxury house. And there's nothing wrong with inferior products, and usually they sell at a lower price. Tissue paper sells very cheap. I mean, you can buy tissue paper per tissue very, very cheap. Paper plates, you can buy, I don't know, 100 of them for a buck or two or something like that. So there's nothing wrong with slum anything. We have slum clothing, we have slum cars, we have slum this, slum that. And why are tenants attracted to it? Because it's cheap. So there's nothing wrong with a very inferior product that's cheap. You want a really good plate, you might pay $100 for a plate. You want a reasonably good a china plate, it might cost $5. You want a plastic plate, a good quality plastic plate, it might cost $1. You want a paper plate, it might cost 0.1 cent. That would be the equivalent of – wait, I have to wave around a paper plate. They say to be a good professor, you're supposed to show examples of it. Well, here's a paper plate. How much was this paper plate? It didn't cost too much. This is a slum plate. Now, it's clean, but, you know, you use it once and you got to throw it away because, you know, the liquid goes right through it. There's nothing wrong with inferior products, which usually sell at a lower price. And why shouldn't people have a choice of a tire that will last for 100 years, a tire that lasts for 1 year, and the tire that will only last for 1 year is going to be a slum tire. So we should prohibit slum tires, slum cars. Look, suppose we said we want to get rid of every car that's lower quality than a Cadillac. We now will have Cadillacs, Maseratis, Porsches, whatever. Do you think people would be better off if we eliminated all the slum cars, namely anything less than a Cadillac quality? No, then people have to ride on bicycles if they couldn't afford a Cadillac. So if we make a law saying we shouldn't have any slum housing and the slum lord is evil, I don't know why they call him a lord. He's not a lord. He's just a merchant selling or renting slum apartments. And nothing wrong with slum apartments. And, you know, Robert Nozick has this expression, capitalist acts between consenting adults. If I want to rent you a lousy apartment that's sort of rickety and half falling down, and the only way I'm going to get you to rent that is a very cheap price, and you're happy because you don't want to spend all your money on that. You have other reasons that you want to spend your – other things you want to spend your money on, and we consummate a deal. Why should that have bad press? Well, the reason it has bad press is that our friends on the left say, this is horrible, I'm exploiting you because I rented you this rickety shack. But I rented you this rickety shack at a very cheap price, and you were happy to have it. So our friends on the left should mind their own business.
Well, I asked you a question about environmentalism earlier, and in the first Defending the Undefendable, you had a little section on ecology. So the litterer, you defend the person who litters.
Yes.
How do you do that?
I defend with my legerdemain and by being sneaky. No, I'm kidding. You know, it's interesting. When you go to a ball game, a baseball game, a football game, you buy peanuts and Cracker Jacks and you buy beer. And at the end of the game, 75,000 people leave there and it takes a couple of hours for them to clean it up. Is that litter? No, it's not litter. Nobody fines you for that. The owner of the baseball stadium wants you to come in there and drop a peanut shell on the floor. He doesn't care. He wants you to be comfortable. It's not litter. It's just, I don't know, garbage or part of the service that the stadium is providing you with. Where then is litter? It's only on public property. For some reason, if you drop something on public street, you're a litterer. If you drop it on a private area, you're not a litterer. Look, look at my coffee. There's litter all over the place. No, there's not litter. It's just mess. It's a messy. If this is a public office, then it would be litter. So the reason I defend the litterer is because what the litterer is really doing is attacking public property. I hate to sound like a broken record, private property, private property, private property, but I'm a broken record, private property, private property, private property. And littering is undermining public property because you can't undermine private property by dropping a wrapper or something because it's not litter. So what this chapter says is that there's nothing wrong with dropping garbage or something on public property, on private property, because the owner of the private property is happy to have you do that.
There's somebody in the chat here for this who's questioning the – basically what they're trying to figure out is the right to freedom of movement, how to make that jibe with everything being private property.
Well – first of all, we libertarians don't believe in any positive rights. We only believe in negative rights. Namely, there's no right to food, there's no right to shelter, there's no right to clothing, there's no right to movement, there's no right to friendship. The only rights we have are negative rights. We have the right not to be murdered. We have the right not to be stolen from. We have the right not to be raped, not to be kidnapped. That's it. So there is no right to movement. So I'll change the question is, how can we enhance the, what would I call it? The benefit of moving. Like, in other words, if you said, how can we maximize food? I would say, well, let's have private property and farming and we'll maximize food. How can we maximize housing? Let's have private property and housing. Well, how can we maximize movement, which is a part of the GDP or part of the wealth? How can we maximize that aspect of wealth? Well, let's have private roads. Private roads, you'll move around much easier because 40,000 of you won't be killed. And that's one way of moving around, not being killed. I mean, if you're killed, you're not really getting much movement. You're sort of sitting there or lying there. So with regard to any of these positive things, they're not rights, but they're values. They're parts of wealth. How do we maximize wealth? Always with private property and free enterprise. And the same thing applies to every aspect of wealth, including transportation. How do we maximize transportation? We allow Uber. We don't prohibit Uber. We allow, private buses, and we privatize railroads, and we privatize highways, and we privatize the Mississippi River. We privatize everything, and that will enhance wealth, and it will enhance every aspect of wealth, food wealth, clothing wealth, shelter wealth, movement wealth.
Now, there's one here. It's actually the very last thing that you talk about in the book is the employer of child labor. And considering a bunch of people are saying that Trump wants to roll back these child labor laws, how do you defend the employer of child labor?
Right. Well, look, child labor isn't a good thing. I'm not pro child labor. However, if we prohibit child labor, we worsen our economic condition. Look, suppose we went back in a time machine. We're back now in the 15th century. And we say nobody under 16 can work. Would we be doing anyone a favor? No. We'd have mass deaths because we were so poor in the 15th century that we needed everyone to work who was above, 4 or 5 years old. And if we said that if you're 15 or 16, you can't work, we'd have mass deaths of children. So then we went to the 17th century and we had a little bit of the Industrial Revolution and we got richer. And guess what? Now we could afford to have 5-year-olds not work. And then we go another 50 years and we can afford to have 7-year-olds not work. And then we go another 50 or 80 years and now 9-year-olds don't have to work. And guess what? What the government did is had child labor laws every time wealth, increasing wealth, made it possible for us to not have children of a certain age work. They passed the law saying that those kids can't work. Namely, they try to get credit for children not working when the real credit was due to increasing wealth. Because if you did it too soon, if you did it precipitously, in the 15th century, you said no one under 21 can work, we'd have mass deaths. So we're against child labor, but the question is, how do we get rid of child labor? Do we get rid of child labor by passing a law against child labor? If we do, we're going to create misery. Now, there are certain countries now that are really have an economy, something like the 15th century, very, very poor countries, where what the kids do is they go to the garbage places and they get scrap food. Suppose, or they're working in a factory. There's child labor working in, a shirt factory in some of these very poor countries. And what they found is that if you pass a law saying they can't do it, what are they going to then do? What they're going to then do is become prostitutes. Well, that's not good. We don't want child prostitutes because we want those kids to live. And right now they're living and they're working in a sweatshop. My buddy Ben Powell, Texas Tech, has done a book on sweatshops. He's sort of my guru, my maven on sweatshops. And what he says, and my own research bears this out, is that when you preclude children from working in a sweatshop, then they go to their next best thing. The reason that they're in the sweatshop in the first place is because that's their best option. And if you take their best option away, they go to their second best option, and their second best option is a lot worse than their first best option. So you're not doing them any favors by saying that they can't work in a sweatshop any more than you'd be doing favors if you went back to the 15th century and said that 5-year-olds can't work. Well, then they'd die. So I defend child labor on the ground that it saves lives. And that the reason we have it is because we're so poor. And the reason we're so poor is because we don't have enough free enterprise. And if you really want to get rid of child labor the right way, have free enterprise. And then children won't have to work because we'll be rich enough so that we can all live without their additional little bit of labor.
That Thank you for that explanation, because that's that's an awesome explanation. When you look at emerging economies that are coming out of just the worst kind of horror, like South Korea, you know, after the Korean War, and we saw that children were working in factories. Children were working at that time, but you know, it's taken a generation or two, but it's gotten to the point where their economic, you know, their economic freedom index has gone through the roof and children don't have to work anymore. It's much what North Korea did. North Korea instituted its own form of socialism, and it's been, I mean, there's concentration camps there. So yeah, I mean, child labor sounds horrible, but if we look at, you know, this country had child labor at one point, it doesn't need child labor right now. Although in a free market, if we were truly deregulated in a free market economy, who knows? Yeah. I mean, it may just, some children may want to work. So thank you. Thank you for that. That's a great explanation on a subject that is very touchy for a lot of people. But I want to address a subject that is probably, if I look down the table of defending the undefendable, the one that gets me crazy, the one that I would say is the one that would trigger me, is defending the person who yells fire in a crowded theater.
Right. Let me do that.
So, yeah, please.
But this will have to be the last one, because I've allotted an hour for us. Nope. And we're just coming close to the end of the hour.
And that's exactly what, this was the last one I was going to ask.
Okay, perfect. We're in sync. The reason I wrote this is there was some famous judge, a Supreme Court judge, I forget who it was, and what he said is, look, free speech is not absolute. Yes, we favor free speech, but there are limits to free speech. For example, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. And then they started adding other limitations to free speech. Well, you can't do this, you can't do that. But the yelling fire in a crowded theater was the key element of reducing free speech. Now, look, I'm not a free speech absolutist. I'm a moderate. That's why they call me Walter Moderate Block. There are certain speech elements that should be prohibited by law. For example, if you don't give me money, I'm going to kill you. That's a threat. Now, obviously, I'm not serious. I'm not going to, you know, kill you if you don't give me money. That the whole thing is silly. I'm just using it as an example. But if I was serious, that I would be a criminal just for saying that. So I'm not a free speech absolutist. I don't say you should be able to speak anything you want or write anything you want. There are threats, and threats are the entire libertarian postulate or premise is based on the non-aggression principle. We say you have no right to initiate violence or threaten the initiation of violence. So I'm not an absolutist. Now, how can I defend yelling fire in a crowded theater? And the way I do it is I say there's an SM theater, a sadomasochist theater. Before I continue, I have to tell you my SM joke. The masochist says to the sadist, beat me. And the sadist says, no.
I get it.
Now, look, you perverts, the way you SM people do, you whip each other, you do things like that. But my version of sadomasochism, we don't whip each other. What we do is we yell far in a crowded theater, and then everyone rushes to the exits, and we all crunch. Look, if you haven't tried it, don't knock it. You know, just because you sadomasochists like to whip each other, there are, you know, be understanding. Now, look, in this theater, I have to put a big sign on the thing, and on the every ticket, I have to say this is an SM theater, and yelling fire and rushing to the exits and getting crunched will be allowed. In the ordinary theater, if you do that and there's no fire, well, you're violating the contract. And part of private property rights is contract. So the reason you don't have this in the ordinary theater is because this is implicit contract or even explicit contract. You go in a theater, sit there and shut up. Or, well, you can laugh or clap or something like that. But, you know, don't make a pain in the neck out of yourself. And one way to make a pain in the neck out of yourself is to yell fire. So in the ordinary theater, you should not yell fire unless there's a fire. But is there something per se evil about yelling fire in a crowded theater? Have I come up with one counterexample? Yes, I think I have. Namely, when the owner and manager allows this and the customers all appreciate this, and you get a whole bunch of SM people of the yelling fire crowded theater type, not the whipping type. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just consenting adult behavior. It's a little weird, but, you know, we fire yellers are misunderstood people, and you straight people should respect our individuality.
Well, I really, really want to thank you for this. Thank you for this time. I know that when it comes to anarcho-capitalists especially, the questions that the hardest questions they have is what would a private society where everything was privately owned look like? It's very easy to stumble, and you've been doing this work for so long. And, I use we because when I told a bunch of people that you were going to be on, and everybody was really excited about it. So, we thank you for this time, and hopefully we can study these arguments and use them properly and honor you in the way we use them.
Well, thanks. It was a delight. You asked great questions. You're a wonderful interviewer, so I thank you for the opportunity to be with you and your gang.
Thank you very much, Dr. Block. Have a great evening.
Take care. Have a good night.